Hi, this is Barry List at Informs, the Institute for Operations Research in the Management Sciences. You're listening to Science of Better, a series of podcasts about ways that analytics and math modeling help people like you and organizations like your own. A massive tsunami and nuclear crisis in Japan. A devastating earthquake in Haiti. Continued problems worldwide with drought and starvation. All these have been recent natural disasters that required massive, well-organized rescue and humanitarian relief. In today's segment, we speak with Professors Pinar Keskinochak and Julie Swan. Together with Özlem Ergun, they are the editors of a special edition of the Informs Journal Interfaces dedicated to humanitarian logistics. All three are directors of the Center for Health and Humanitarian Logistics at the Georgia Institute of Technology. Professor Keskinochak, Professor Swan, welcome back to the Science of Better.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Let's begin with Professor Swan. It seems to me that a large part of the humanitarian area is preparing and worrying. What types of things do you and the authors of these papers worry most about?
Well, certainly one area is the area of disasters. And when you look at disasters, there are a number of characteristics that come into play. For instance, you have a lot of uncertainty about where or when a disaster will hit or how big it will be. You also have different vulnerabilities of different populations, and you have different local capacities to respond, as we've seen, for instance, in Haiti versus Chile, where there were both earthquakes. The first few hours in responding to a disaster are critical, and to respond well in those first few hours, you really need to have done significant planning in advance. And so that's an area where the ORMS area can help out in thinking about disasters. Another area that's very important in disasters is the last mile, and that means getting products or services or people from an area down to actually the beneficiaries where they are needed. And often that last mile is more challenging than the rest of the supply chain.
It's a little bit like the golden minute, I think they say, when a person's had a heart attack and is waiting for medical care.
That's true. That
or the golden first, hour.
Sure, that golden hour might be similar to the first 48 hours of a disaster.
What led to the publication of this overview of the ways that logistics and operations research are used to help with these problems? Professor Keskinochak, perhaps you could take that on.
Barry, as you know, operations research has had an impact in the public sector for many decades, dating to 60s and 70s and maybe before. The areas range from urban emergency systems to healthcare to homeland security, policy modeling, education, and the list goes on. When we look at the decisions in the public sector, they all require the analysis of complex situations in which the use of RMS in decision-making can have a positive societal impact. So given this potential, the interest in public sector applications within our professional community has been growing and spreading. And a few years ago, it led to the establishment of a new section on public program service and needs.
At Informs.
Yes, it's within Informs, and we call it SPPSN for short. So it's one of the Informs sections. Julie Swan, Özlem Ergun, and I, along with several others at Informs, have been among the co-founders and officers of SPPSN, and we observed firsthand the great interest from our community in these areas. There's also, as you know, the Doing Good with Good OR student paper competition.
And that stands for Doing Good with Good Operations Research, a program that was begun by MIT professor Cynthia Barnhart.
Exactly. So Cindy has been among the leaders, and then several others have been involved. So it's a relatively newly established award which received a lot of attention within the Informs community. So given all this interest, our motivation in co-editing this special issue came from our desire to highlight some of the recent RMS research with positive societal impact and also encourage more participation in these areas from researchers and practitioners in our community. So ultimately, our desire is to see an increased impact of RMS on the society and the human welfare.
In my introduction, I spoke about the use of operations research and disaster planning and response, but this issue also looks at humanitarian apps that promote human welfare in general. What are some of the broad issues that need to be tackled by planners in the next 50 years, issues where math modeling can be of major help? Professor Swan, perhaps you'd like to take that on.
Let me take first a list of some of the most important issues and then point out some of the areas where math modeling might be able to help in those areas. I like to use the list that was created by a chemistry professor, Richard Smalley, who's a Nobel Prize winning professor, but he also went to the public in many of his lectures and tried to come up with a list of the most important problems that would face humanity in the next 50 years and in some kind of ranking based on importance. Those problems include things like energy, water, food, environment, poverty, terrorism and war, disease, education, democracy, and population. As you can see, it's a pretty weighty list in terms of how important the problems are.
Yes, it is.
And as we grow from a world of 6 billion people to a world of 10 billion people over the next 50 years, it's clear that there'll be limited resources in multiple areas. I think that in some of these areas, of course, technology plays a role and science plays a role and the social sciences as well. But I think math modeling can look at some aspects such as resource allocation. It can look at prediction types of issues, particularly around the long term. The ORMS tools can also help with issues around sustainability and new system design. And I think one of the other things that's important about these large-scale problems for humanity is that they often require interdisciplinary approaches where you need to combine math modeling with taking into account human issues or other types of... And I should also point out that while these are certainly important for the developing world, many of these problems also exist even in places like the United States, where there may be many households and children who don't have good access to nutritious food. So I think that there are a lot of opportunities for OR and MS researchers to look at areas related to these problems.
Let's zero in on one paper that Professor Keskin-Ochak was a co-author on. And that's about pre-positioning emergency supplies for the relief group CARE International. Professor, what's so tricky about deciding where to stockpile relief supplies?
Barry, first let me give a quick snapshot of this disaster situation in the world as we know it today. So if you remember in 2010 and maybe even early 2011, we had a lot of natural disasters, including the earthquakes in Haiti and Chile, floods in Pakistan, volcano eruption and tsunami in Indonesia, and, of course, the recent earthquake in Japan, just to name a few. And while we wish that the past 1.5 years was an exception, when we look at the history, unfortunately, this indicates otherwise. Thousands of disasters occurred over the past couple of decades, affecting millions of people, claiming lives, damaging infrastructure, and changing social and economic conditions. And as Julie mentioned, as we move forward into the future, the frequency and the magnitude of these disasters and their impact is also expected to grow. So that's why the humanitarian sector is increasingly looking into stockpiling disaster relief supplies, with the goal of reaching the affected areas in a timely manner. In terms of the decisions, there are many challenges in the decisions related to stockpiling relief supplies. First of all, the demand is highly uncertain due to the unpredictable nature of most of these disasters in terms of timing, location, and magnitude. Also, the need for relief aid depends heavily on how prepared the local population is. The same event may have very different implications depending on where it occurs. All of these factors and uncertainties make it difficult to estimate and model the demand and to decide how much of which item to stock in which locations.
Taking a step back, you write about three stages in the disaster timeline: preparedness, response, and recovery. How does your research fit in?
So let me briefly define those stages. A typical disaster starts with efforts on mitigation and preparedness and then continues with response and recovery after the event. Then the loop closes back to preparedness based on the learnings from the recovery phase. The preparedness stage focuses on educating the public and building physical and human capacity that can be mobilized when a disaster hits. Then the response stage kicks in, which begins immediately after the onset of a disaster and includes activities such as assessment of needs, procurement, transportation, storage, and the last mile delivery. And finally, the recovery phase focuses on debris clearance and disposal, rebuilding infrastructure, reestablishing communities, and of course, incorporating lessons learned in future mitigation and preparedness activities.
Your team recommended positioning relief supplies in three strategic places across the world. Where are these places, and what was the process involved in picking them?
We considered various factors in our analysis of potential locations for pre-positioning relief supplies. We utilized a multi-year data set on worldwide disasters, along with the operational guidelines from the IFRC, the International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies. So we first tried to understand the nature of demand in various parts of the world in face of different types of disasters. This led us to identify 22 demand points through some aggregation, each corresponding to a sub-region in the world. And CARE provided us with potential pre-positioning locations, UNHRD, and response depot locations. So when we considered the transportation times from local and global suppliers, as well as from potential pre-positioning sites to each of the demand points, that basically constituted the amount of input that went into the analysis. So putting all of it together, we developed a model to determine the best locations for a given number of warehouses with the goal of reducing the response time. So after this analysis, we found that the impact on the response time exhibited diminishing returns, as one might expect, as we increased the number of warehouses and stabilized around four warehouses. So we recommended CARE to operate three or four warehouses depending on resource availability, starting with the first warehouse in Middle East, expanding to Central America, and then to Southeast Asia. Considering our recommendations and also their collaboration with other humanitarian organizations, CARE decided to establish its first pre-positioning facility in Dubai. That was in 2008. And its second and third in Panama and Cambodia, and that was in 2009.
And before we leave this subject, I just wanted to ask, are the warehouses now open, and are there any practical examples of how your research has helped?
Yes, the warehouses are open, and they have actually been used in some of the recent disaster response, in particular with the positioning of water purification kits. So CARE definitely has seen the impact of these warehouses in their disaster response.
Professor Swan, OR is frequently associated with logistics, but another key paper in this special issue deals with a medical problem related to hepatitis B vaccines, and not with distribution, but with assessing the cost effectiveness of screening, treatment, and vaccination. What was studied here, and who were the beneficiaries of the research?
Thanks, Barry. One of the interesting things about this paper is that it does address policy issues that, as you've pointed out, and it shows how math modeling can be used to address policy questions. And to do that, this team of authors worked directly with several different groups, which then enhanced the probability that their work would be implemented. So they worked with the Asian Liver Center at Stanford University. They also worked quite closely with the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta, the CDC, and they worked with policymakers in China. The problem that they were addressing is on the chronic disease of hepatitis B, an infectious disease, which affects about 10% of some populations, particularly Asian populations, in America, including immigrants and others. Asian Pacific Islanders are one of the groups they focused on. And in China, they specifically looked at school children. And so this paper looked, as you mentioned, at screening, treatment, and vaccination, and looked at the trade-offs of various combinations of those strategies. They found that for the U.S. for adult Asian and Pacific Islanders, that the best strategy would be to screen and treat the population, including some vaccinations for the close members that were closely connected with those populations. But the universal vaccination was not cost-effective in this case. In the case of school children in China, they found that a catch-up vaccination program would be quite effective in terms of both the impact on the children as well as the cost. And already the CDC guidelines have changed regarding recommendations about hepatitis B, and that's one of the really exciting things about this paper. I'd also like to point out that this paper was the first winner of the Doing Good with Good OR competition of INFORMS, which is another signal of the impact that the work has had.
And has it been implemented yet, or are we still in the ramp-up process?
My understanding of the paper is that the CDC guidelines have already changed and that this research had an impact on that. The team worked directly with the CDC both to help develop the aspects of the model as well as to share the results coming out from the model. And so, yes, this paper has had a direct impact on public policy. I would say also it's useful to point out that papers that are published in the Interfaces Journal are required to show that they've had impact on an organization in terms of the decisions and the cost or other performance measures that are of interest in that area. So all of the papers in this special issue have documented impact on organizations.
Our memory of yesterday's news can be fleeting, but one of these studies in this issue deals with the dread that struck the headlines when swine flu broke out in Mexico and threatened to become a pandemic affecting the rest of North America and indeed the world. How did one team of authors model the spread of disease in a pandemic, and how did they make allowances for the different ways that disease can spread in different countries, different societies? Professor Swan, I think that you worked on this one.
Sure. And before I address the pandemic paper, let me also comment about the hepatitis work. In 2009, China declared it would provide free catch-up vaccination to all children in China under 50 age. And so that's a direct impact of children in China that has resulted, at least in part, because of the work done on hepatitis B. Let me look at pandemic now. Influenza pandemic is really an interesting area when you think about it. Experts have known for a long time that influenza pandemics come about the ears, and they can be quite large, affecting large segments of the population, resulting in great mortality and morbidity. So experts had known that a pandemic was coming, but you don't know exactly when it's coming or exactly where it's coming from, or even the characteristics of the pandemic. So when the outbreak occurred in Mexico in the spring, I think it was 2009, there was a lot of fear about what to do. Researchers had been looking at influenza pandemic for some time, were thus set up to help provide advice on how to deal with the pandemic. In this case, the team of authors looked at the spread of the disease, but needed to adapt models to deal with their particular setting, which was an urban area in Canada where health care was quite available. The team developed a simulation that allowed the rates and contacts of transmission to be different for different population groups, different times of the day, and other aspects, really incorporating a lot of the heterogeneity that can occur in transmission of diseases. Now, we were very fortunate that for the H1N1 outbreak, the results were not as severe as expected, but the virus can still mutate and come back a couple years later. You still need to be worried about these types of issues. And in addition to influenza, of course, you can have pandemic other types. This particular work is being used with for planning purposes in Canada, and so that's some of the particular work it had.
We only have time for one or two more questions. In the introduction to the special issue, you point to the cascading effects of the disaster in Japan and the fact that operations researchers can help with that specific area in the future. And how can OR help with something as terrible as what happened in Japan? Because as we know, first there was an earthquake, then there were the waters of a tsunami, and because the tsunami waters were so high, they disabled nuclear reactors, and you had a third crisis, a nuclear crisis. And Professor Keskinochak, how would an OR person deal with this cascading issue?
Yes, Barry, you gave a very good overview. So the events took place in March, in early March, starting with an earthquake, which triggered a massive tsunami and followed by several aftershocks. And as you mentioned, even though several nuclear reactors automatically shut down, there were problems at the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear plant due to issues with the cooling systems. And this is what led to a nuclear emergency. So the combination of these events caused thousands of people to move to shelters, left millions of homes without power and water, led to shortages in basic commodities, and unfortunately many people lost their lives. So it's been a tremendous impact. So these events remind us once again that even the most economically and technologically advanced and best prepared nations are still vulnerable to disasters. So I guess the thing to note in the Japan case is that they've experienced not just one, but a combination of multiple cascading sudden onset, basically they were unpredictable, natural and man-made disasters. These had unpredictable timing, unpredictable location to some degree. And these types of disasters are among the hardest to prepare and respond, even if they occur in isolation. The combined impact of cascading disasters is often much larger than the sum of the potential impact of each individual disaster. We have seen this also with the earthquake and tsunami in Indonesia, and of course Hurricane Katrina in the U.S. While there's been some progress in predicting and preparing for individual disasters, to our knowledge, we currently do not have a good understanding of potential scenarios for cascading disasters. I would argue that given its variety of tools and techniques, ORMS could definitely play an important role here in terms of advancing the science and technology for modeling and forecasting scenarios of multiple events happening sequentially and their impact on the infrastructure.
So it might be possible to ask a series of what-if questions, not only looking back, of course, at Japan, but looking at other parts of the world and say, what is the possibility that if failure one takes place, there will be a failure two, three, and perhaps even four, and then start to prepare for those?
Exactly. I think one could definitely explore such scenarios, and again, analyzing those scenarios and making predictions or preparedness decisions would require a systems approach, and that's really what OR is very good about, not only analyzing and optimizing individual systems in isolation, but taking a systems approach and looking at the interactions between multiple systems.
Final question, what are some of the local causes? We talked a moment ago about broad major issues, but what are some of the local causes in which OR can help, things like education, foster care, food banks? Professor Swan, we'll let you have the last word.
Great. I know that there are many researchers who would like to have an impact on society with at least part of what they do, and it can be very difficult to get started in the humanitarian area, particularly in issues at the international level. But I think starting locally can be a lot easier because the proximity allows you to develop a close collaboration with organizations. I know that there have been researchers both at Georgia Tech and many other universities who looked at organizations like the local food bank or the local school system and used OR and MS methods to help those areas, such as looking at the logistics, allocation, or the warehouses of the food banks themselves. One can also look to the library system, civic institutions like police, health institutions like hospitals. So there are a variety of different organizations and areas where you could apply ORMS tools and get started in having some societal impact with some of the work that you do. One of the things that's worked for some universities is to involve students in some of these projects. It can be students at the undergraduate level, or it can be students at the graduate level through master's or PhD courses. And by involving students, you can provide some resources to some of these local organizations that are often quite limited in their resources, and you can provide a very interesting experience for students in seeing how OR and MS can be applied not only in the areas they typically learn about in their classrooms, but also in these perhaps less traditional areas. And you can start by approaching organizations and just talking to them and finding out what some of their key challenges are, both currently, but then also for the next few years, as you think about ways that OR and MS can help to address some of the problems in these areas. Foster care is another one where there perhaps been less attention, and then there are other areas, even like the criminal justice system, that have received some attention from ORMS researchers, but there may be other opportunities to look at that. So certainly we encourage many researchers in the ORMS area to think about how they can get involved and have some societal impact in some of these areas.
That's all the time we have today. We've been talking with Professors Pinar Keskinochak and Julie Swan of Georgia Tech about a special edition of the journal Interfaces dedicated to humanitarian logistics. Thank you both for talking with us.
Thank you, Ben. It's been our pleasure.
Thanks for your time.
And thank you for listening to the Science of Better podcast by INFORMS, the Institute for Operations Research and the Management Sciences. For more information about operations research and this series, visit us on the web at www.informs.org. Thank you, and remember, keep on crunching those numbers.